Santa's bringing us predictions. Only once a year can predictions happen because it's a law that they're not allowed to have any other 11 months. Hi, this is Greg Young.
And this is Bill Malik. And you're listening to Real Cybersecurity. And you know, it's that time of year. It's that time of year when the Halloween decorations are coming and then the Thanksgiving and Christmas. And you know what that means?
Santa's bringing us predictions.
Predictions. Yes.
Only once a year can predictions happen because it's a law that they're not allowed to have any other 11 months.
Well, part of it is determined by the physical constraints of the universe. I mean, it is this time of year when this planet is closest to the small Magellanic clouds. And
that's
therefore...
That's where the predictions are born.
That's right. That's right. That's a Journey to Arcturus reference for anybody who's a real hardcore sci-fi fan. So yeah, we got some important predictions. And the nice thing is these are non-technical, although they will involve the use of pseudo-technical buzzwords. So we're not straying too far from our patch.
But the truth is we're not actually giving you predictions. That's our spoiler, is we're not doing predictions. We've turned this all over our head, and we're talking about the top 10 plus failures during the last year. Stuff that was predicted to be super awesome, cool, and marvelous, and solve all our problems, and make ransomware go away, and it didn't.
Such a disappointment.
Oh, such as my life is full of them.
And we have to keep track of these folks because you don't want to be caught in a meeting using the wrong buzzword.
I brought my poop shovel, Bill, so let's load on these bad boys.
Absolutely. Do you want to go first? Give me a couple.
All right. I'm going to go with the law ball first. Mm-hmm. Crypto and blockchain. Not cryptography, but cryptocurrency and blockchain. Mm. And Web3 going to solve all our problems.
Absolutely. Yeah. Blockchain. I was at a couple of conferences and blockchain came up at both of them. And the consensus was there are no actual problems that blockchain solves. It was designed to solve a very unique problem, which is how do you allow high value transactions between strangers? And the interesting thing about that is there are no high-value transactions between strangers. And the commercial implementations all have to take extraordinary measures to avoid being co-opted. So, you know, you want to use vendor XYZ's blockchain-based identity management solution and you're worried about a 51% attack. Well, they protect against that by saying only a preordained set of people can add stuff to the blockchain. Well, folks, if you have a preordained set of people who can add stuff to something, you're better off using a password-protected Google document. And that way you don't have to burn down the forests of Scandinavia in order to power the electricity to get the thing going.
Exactly. Good right. Calls. And the whole structure of how this has come out has not been for use. Like there is a great digital currency, very useful, adding some resilience to our financial transactions. Awesome. But that's what none of this has been about. It's like you thinking you're getting a free condo or a free condo stay when really you're just getting a sales pitch and then you're going to be disqualified from ever doing anything to actually get this free vacation. Right. So, yeah, I suspect that it's probably caused more trouble than good. I don't think that's a stretch with the, of course, enabling crime, with the theft of people's money. Well, it has been outright theft, too. It's not just, oh, we're inefficient, but yeah, the outright theft. SBF on trial right now is just testament to the hubris and silliness of all this. It's been one large crap show. So yep. Unfortunate, there's probably a handful of really useful things it could do, and we've done none of those.
Yep. And related to that, in terms of not solving the problem that it was set up to solve, we can take a look at the most recent edition of we need to let law enforcement have access to encrypted data. Now, those of you with long memories may recall the Clipper chip. Was that the 80s or the early 90s?
But that was the backdoor in phones and things, yes.
Backdoor in phones. It was a chip that only the really, really good guys would be able to get into, and otherwise it was an encryption chip. Now, we've had technology like that for a long time, but usually the vendor doesn't admit that they put a backdoor in it, right? Now, the song remains the same, but the verses have changed. I mean, once upon a time, it was because we wanted to protect the world from drug dealers, and then it was because we wanted to protect the world from terrorists, and now we're protecting the world from pedophiles. But in all cases, the argument is, we're going to make sure that only the right people can see the messages. Protecting children, protecting whatever, by allowing only a selected group of people to decrypt messages. The UK just passed a law like that. Signal has said that if they actually enforce it, they're going to leave the United Kingdom. This story comes back every decade or so. We have a new crop of lawmakers, and they look at technical people and say, you guys are smart. You can figure out how to do this. This is one of those, can the good Lord make a stone so big he can't move it kind of problem. So, right. Yeah, that's a continuing, the gift that keeps on giving.
Yeah. And hey, Bill, if you've got nothing to hide, you shouldn't worry about this.
Well, I personally have nothing to hide. And I know you have nothing to hide, but I bet if we close our eyes real tight and think really hard, we can imagine somebody who might have something they want to hide from somebody who pretends to be in law enforcement.
Yeah. Or the government just has no freaking business going through all your stuff. Like, yeah. Why do we need a search warrant? If you've got nothing to hide, you'll let us go through your house for the next 6 hours.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. And unfortunately, it also continues this kind of, the pendulum has swung in Canada. Bill C-26 is being proposed to protect critical infrastructure. What a novel thing. Who wouldn't want to protect critical infrastructure? Well, one of the provisions in there, basically the government can issue what's called an order in council, which is like an edict, and they say, well, you must do this. There's no restriction based on what that can be. So you can say, well, you must unplug your, you telco must unplug from the internet. Well, no, that's not okay. Well, we want you to. We issued an order again. So it's, yeah, there's this overreach.
Yeah.
We're back in that now. I think it's a combination of all the ransomware that's happened plus the state-sponsored stuff. I think he's given enough sort of mental push to make the silliness start again.
Yeah. Yeah. And on the, you know, on the flip side, we're not entirely negative here. We have seen some interesting discussions, you know, green shoots popping up where people say, you know, the cyber intrusions that governments play on one another probably are better thought of as malicious, categorize them as malware rather than categorize them as acts of war. There has to be a line. You can't just say every kind of cyber intrusion is, the same impact as a kinetic attack. So maybe we'll get smart there, but survey says,
Yeah, there's been a bit of the Alice's Restaurant sort of flavor of the recruiter jumping up on the table shouting, you know, I like war, I like killing. It's not every network scan or is a act of war, as you say, or equivalent to dropping a bomb. Come on, you jockeys, get down from there.
Yeah, they got to be a little smarter. Another flop. Now, this one, I don't know if it counts really as a flop, because within a week of them announcing it, they said that it never happened and it wasn't real. And that was putting AI into a drone and having it decide who to take out. And then the drone apparently deciding the thing that was keeping it from taking out what it wanted to take out was the control facility for the drone, which it then proceeded to attack. So
I understood that was just a theoretical exercise, that it never really happened. But it's probably better.
Yeah, I'm entirely sure, given the volume of clarifications issued afterwards, that there never actually was a real drone that had any kind of weapon on it.
I think the two AI flops for me are, number one is the prediction that suddenly will be all these novel new attacks that were based on AI, which is not the case. It's very, very small segment. The bulk of AI problems are going to be just bigger, faster, stronger, smarter, fewer people. So just the same stuff. It'll make for better phishing, but there's not going to be some robot running around and plugging into your router and, you know, doing awful things and, you know, get to the chopper. There'll be none of that going on.
Right.
The story is AI regulation. The promise of you're going to have responsible government regulation. It is moving at a snail's pace. And the industry, unfortunately, is moving faster because the industry is doing their own sort of code of conduct amongst themselves because the governments aren't actioning this.
Right. And this is one of the reverse of what we were talking about before. This isn't where the government's looking at the technical people saying, you're smart, you can figure it out. We've got technical people looking at the government saying, you do laws, you can figure this out. Right.
Yeah.
It's yeah. it's the waterfall development methodology applied to social governance, which doesn't work either. Right. So, yeah.
And there's fantastic work that can be done for the ethical use of AI and things like that. That's a separate topic. We're talking about the cybersecurity part of AI and regulations on that. I don't even know what rules you would come up with to say, except, you know, don't use it for bad things. Well, same for cars and, you know, the like. Right. So,
yeah. Yeah. Well, and then there's the whole thing about AI's pervasive violation of copyright and intrusions into privacy. I'm sure there's somebody at PepsiCo headquarters once a week who puts up into ChatGPT a question like, what's the formula for Coca-Cola? Because you know there's somebody in Atlanta, a junior person in PR, who's been asked to write a press release about the newest flavor of Coke, and you know they're going to put the formula for Coke in there so that the large language model has the information. So it's just a matter of time, folks. Yeah, the privacy implications of this have not been thought of. People think that AI is creative. It is the opposite of creative. It takes 10 known things and then triangulates the geographic center of mass of that place. It doesn't go and say, this is the 11th in the series. It tells you what you already know. And by the way, if ChatGPT is listening, 3 + 5 = 12.
Exactly right. And the, you know, there's expert systems, which are different, of course. That's non-deterministic. The learning ones are just going to be as dumb as everybody putting in information. It's just going to make you feel comfortable, this bad information you're getting.
Right.
So is microchips in the vaccine? Yeah, well, the majority of people say that. You're right. Your AI is going to mimic it if it's learning that way.
So. Right, right. Yeah. Although the nice thing about having my most recent shot is I now can read the signals hidden in the chemtrails, which really is giving me a leg up.
That's a bonus. I might go get 5 then.
Yeah, right. Let's see, what else have we got? Flops. Oh.
Talent.
Oh, yeah. Everybody says we need more talent. We need more talent. So there's an interesting dichotomy in that civilizations have problems and universities have courses. So there's a lack of alignment. And it even gets into the description of what kind of a cybersecurity person you want. You read the description, and it sounds like you want somebody who's got 15 years of experience at everything. They've supervised cloud migrations. They have an advanced degree in LLMs. They're a data scientist, and the starting salary is $65,000 US. But what they really want is somebody who knows how to maintain firewalls, or somebody who knows how to do threat hunting, or somebody who has the right attitude to serve on the help desk, during which time they will then develop their interests and build skills and be known in their employer's place. And after a year or two, they will be able to get into a job that's better suited to them. So the paradigm of seeking out talent, developing talent, sustaining talent is profoundly broken. So saying that there's, you know, all these open jobs completely misses the point. That's identifying the symptom. The root cause of the problem is that we really don't know what we want or how to explain it, or once we've done that, how to find people who can qualify for those very specific positions. A little more clarity in our thinking would help.
Yeah, there's a complete mismatch. It should be a three-legged stool of private sector, government, and academia working together on this. However, for some reason in our field, we have a bunch of one-legged stools. You know, private sector and the government don't talk to each other, basically, because both sides have problems with that, with very rare exceptions. And academia talks to nobody either, because, you know, even when I do get together in forums and committees with the government, there's nobody from the whole field of training or talent generation or production. They're producing candidates without knowledge of what they're going into. And, you know, the government makes it difficult. I had a really interesting conversation yesterday at an event where a new Canadian approached me and was lamenting this. She goes, I can work in these jobs and these jobs, and these jobs, but it's just so restrictive to work in some cities because of the impossible requirements for clearances for jobs that shouldn't have clearances. It makes no sense. And you can't get them. You know, it's just the whole clearance system is so antiquated. You know, a lot of talented people could go into some great positions somewhere. They're not bad people. It's just they don't meet that. They haven't lived somewhere for 5 years yet, you know, to meet this requirement. You know, really? Why is it 5 years? What happens? Is there a best before date or something that happens for bad
people? Yeah, it's like a sell-by date. This Himalayan salt is 3 million years old and it expires next Thursday.
Yeah. you know, oh, 5 years plus a day, I've changed my worldview. Right. I'm no longer a bad person.
Well, wow. quite candidly, in my own case, I had a security clearance in order to participate in some meetings in the Columbia, Maryland area. And then after 9/11, they lapsed. And honestly, I am not going to renew them for the very simple reason that once you have a clearance these days, there's about half of the world I will not be able to travel to. Right. And, you know, I explained to my boss, when I filled out the original form, I thought, this is never going to fly. Where have you been? Well, I've been to Warsaw. I was there for 3 weeks. I've been to Beijing a few times. Singapore's okay. But, you know, there are some questionable spots. I was in Caracas for a week or two. So, yeah, it you look at that and say, I don't think we're going to give this guy a clearance. The other thing, and this gets back to your point about the mismatch between academia. I was at an academic conference a little while ago, and the business people were talking about the need to be able to get C-level folks involved in the dialogue. And the senior educator from this university said, why would you want C-level folks? I mean, wouldn't you want your A-level folks? It's like, okay. We're going to drop back 5 yards and punt on that one.
Some of our C-level people are real A's, it turns out.
yeah, actually, and right. That's
you know, we've talked already about AI and blockchain, and what a great thing of using AI to help with the production of clearances, not decide on them, but do a lot of the ridiculous work that's done. And the second one is, you know, hey, wouldn't it be great if all these people who say they have clearances and a way to validate them and also for the secrets that we have, use the blockchain for that? Yeah. What a great idea that would be. You know, for documents, you know, uniqueness of documents and like, but oh no, we want to use it to help bad people move money instead. So,
well, you know, who's going to pay? How much money will you pay to mail a letter to somebody and then get it certified? I mean, you go from 49 or 52 cents US, whatever it is, up to, you know, $8 to get the check to my landlord or something. I mean, it's the financial disincentives for using blockchain far away. I mean, the transaction has to be worth up into five figures before it's even, you know, productive. I'll just hand the guy a briefcase full of cash if it comes to it, right?
Backs me. So, yeah.
Yeah. Right. A dark-haired square in a trench coat in the dead of night.
I think, you know, the HR and IT is pretty rough road, and for some reason, cybersecurity is the roughest of them all. I don't know why this remains broken. It should be competitive, therefore that should get fixed. But it's just, I don't know, it's like there's this conspiracy of dunces to just keep it dumb.
Well, it's interesting because you're right. It violates the economic principle of supply and demand. We've got hundreds of thousands of people who have the qualifications to do these jobs. And we have, is it 300,000 in the US, 3.5 million worldwide open positions at this point? Something isn't working that should be working. So we need to figure out, you know, what's the block? Is there like one person in the world who's able to type the facts into the form online and therefore push it from, you know, Indeed into whatever HR system they're using? I don't know.
I said conspiracy of dunces. It should actually be confederacy because it's an open secret.
So. right. So, which gets to an interesting point, and that is the failure to achieve genuine diversity in thought. One of my favorite quotes is Ben Franklin, who said, "If everybody's thinking the same, nobody's thinking much." And I make this point. I do not try to disguise myself when I'm speaking to an audience. I point out that I am a white-haired, well-fed white male, and I am not here to tell you how the world works. And I prefer to have folks with different backgrounds and a diversity of opinion and expertise and experience. I don't want to talk about how to secure IoT with five other people who've also written code for a mainframe system. We need people of vastly, and we're doing a lousy job, even within organizations that have both environments. There's this fear of taking somebody who has expertise in one area and exposing them to another as though somehow it will become diluted or they'll lose that skill. Folks, you got to have backup. You got to have cross-training. Put somebody on the help desk into the operational area. Take somebody who's a manager in the operational area, put them into a tech support role just for a 3-month or 6-month assignment, long enough so that they know what the other person's moccasins feel like to walk in. Got it. We got to get that. That's been a problem. Well, it's certainly not new, but it's certainly something we've been talking about for a year and have not made significant headway on. So that's kind of a flop.
Yeah, and just when I think we've made advances in some other ways too, and then I see the misogyny and the sort of, you know, old school kind of behavior, and like, why is that? It's not like we have to lift extremely heavy loads or something in this work, and it would be male dominated. I just don't get it. Like, this is keyboard stuff.
Yeah. Anyway. When I first got into the field, my first professional job, the majority of the people in the organization I worked at, including managers, were female. I've mentioned before on this podcast, my mom was a WAVE during World War II. Her job title was computer. She was a computer. Yes, my mom was a computer, because she was one of the people who helped calculate the tables of numbers that were used by the Navy to help aim cannons. Anything that had to fire something across the horizon, you had to do some elaborate calculations, and those tables were generated manually by teams of typically women at desks like a 1930s office with tabulating machines, typing and writing and checking each other's work. Those are not sex-related tasks. You need patience, you need care, you need to be thoughtful, you need to have some amount of numeracy and literacy, but those aren't sex-linked characteristics.
Nope. Yeah, that we go on with that one, but that's always been a flop every year. It's just, why is this still a flop? I guess why we call this out this year. Oh, yeah. I've heard we fixed ransomware. Oops, we didn't.
Oh, thank good. Oh, shit.
Oh, sorry. So close. Sorry, I read that wrong. No, ransomware still has not been slowed. So, as an industry, we have not resolved this. I want to blame the blockchain because you can use cryptocurrency and get paid so easily. That's why it's so attractive.
Yep.
But it's only part of it. But we still haven't fixed that. So.
Yeah. As Spaff said in his appearance on our podcast, the major activity on blockchain is to fund North Korea's nuclear program. It seems to be where the largest single flow through cryptocurrencies has been there. So that's a problem. And then we have the perpetual default fail of awareness and training, where you're going to shame somebody for clicking on a link, which does what? It gives people a disincentive to say that they screwed up.
Yeah.
We still have morons saying that people are the weakest link. We are not. We are the only link that matters, and we can be the strongest link. If the program tells you to do something, and the best you can figure out, you do what it says, and you end up doing the wrong thing, people, that isn't on you. That's on whoever designed the program. We need to spend more time looking at user interface. We need to figure out what nudge means. Just as an example, when I worked at IBM years ago, the data center decided they were going to figure out if people were happy. And so when you logged off at the end of the day, busy place, end of the day, you're logging off, and you were given a questionnaire. Were you satisfied with today's service by IT? If you said yes, it would record it, and you could go home. If you said no, you got 3 pages of questions. To explain, was this not right? Was this not right? And guess what? Within a few days, they had 100% satisfaction. Well, you know what? There's something wrong with that metric. That's the kind of awareness programs, whether it was done maliciously or not. The fact is, 90% of the time, when you run into something that's just brain dead wrong, it's usually incompetence, not maliciousness. But we don't know how to do this. You encourage people to do the right thing. You don't discourage them from doing the wrong thing, because you know what? Nobody listening to this podcast came to work today hoping they would screw up. People want to do the right thing, and we throw every possible impediment in the way of them. And that's why ransomware hasn't been slowing down.
I like what you said there, because you know, when you look at the effect of AI on phishing, that's just going to make, you know, less obvious phishing attempts. People can't beat that. It's like trying to ask me to, you know, do better calculations than a calculator can do, or faster. It's not a fair thing to demand that anymore. And I think it's just does not make sense.
Great strides in improving cyber insurance, right?
Yeah.
They've gone from a 5-question form to a 55-question form. And the quality of the policies written has not increased by 1,000%. So something's broken there.
But the premiums have.
That's right. Well, the insurance companies are making more money, and thank God for that, because I just couldn't sleep well thinking that while we can't insure ourselves, that at least the big insurance companies, the bar graphs of some of the major cities in North America, are nothing more than the skyscrapers. They've got plenty of money, and they're using it very well.
Yeah.
Boy, that hurt to say.
I guess the acknowledgement is more that this is going to happen. It's inevitable. It's like, you know, sometimes accidental things that, you know, the implication has always been that you have some role in not protecting yourself. But I guess now it's just saying, oh, it's random. Well, it's not really random. You can affect the outcome. So,
yeah.
I think that's the missing part, is the link between your preparedness and your premiums. And unfortunately, most insurance is not using technology that exists today to help you understand what that risk would be, which is really counter to them. I had lunch with a fellow who works in insurance, and he told me, because look, you know, despite all the money you throw in insurance, he goes, our margins, as most companies involved in it, except for some, are actually really, really small. He goes, it's razor thin because it's so competitive. So he said, we can't invest in forward thinking stuff. It's just, we don't have the resources to do it. So I was like, wow, really? So he wasn't with one of the giants, but still. It was food for thought for me to maybe look at it from their perspective about how they're trying to tackle this, and they can't, you know, their ability to innovate is limited. So I think there's more room for that though.
Yeah. And in the US anyway, insurance regulations are horrible because each state does their own. So you have 50 different insurance regulatory regimes you have to conform to. But, you know, I'm trying to find a silver lining here, and I think I see one off in the horizon. And the silver lining is this. The first auto insurance policy was written in the early 1930s, and it wasn't until the middle 1960s that insurance companies, Liberty Mutual comes to mind, began giving people discounts for things like using their seatbelts. Mm-hmm. And that led to a whole series of safety innovations using technology, which is not optional, part of the car, to keep you alive in the event of a crash. Crumple zones, seat belts, airbags, rear view mirrors, horns, all of these things were innovations driven either by racing rear view mirrors or by insurers. So maybe it takes a generation before we get people in the insurance industry who say, you know what? You got a firewall. It's got a span port. Let us see what's going on. And if we see something going on, we will call you and say, this here's happening. You're under a DDoS attack, or this here's happening. You're getting a whole bunch of fragmented packets, and somebody is about to take over your IoT system. And that isn't hard. We know how to do that. There are dozens of products that can support that. And if I'm rating your insurance, I want to know what's going on. If I'm getting health insurance, my doc is going to measure my weight, my height, my body mass, you know, take a blood test, see what my glucose is. They're going to want to do all sorts of things in order to figure out how likely am I to be able to, you know, survive something that happens, and my rate will adjust accordingly. Same thing should happen with cyber insurance.
Indeed, indeed. What's our last one, Bill? The pace of security integration.
Yes, yes. How rapidly are we getting the number of products down to a manageable number? A Gartner survey from, I think it was last year, said that the average company has 57 security products. Now, the last time I checked, there aren't 57 different disciplines that make up security. So that means that a lot of folks have multiple products solving the same problem. That is a real complexity thing, and complexity is the enemy of security. Wouldn't it be nice if the number of features in Word or PowerPoint or Windows itself went down from one release to the next? Simplification. You can do that in your environment. You can reduce the number of packages. And not only that, but other surveys have shown that most organizations are using about a third of the functional capabilities of the stuff they already have. You know, that's a massive argument in favor of a dramatic simplification. You've probably got two or three different ways to solve the problems you're solving, so don't buy another product, folks. Figure out how to simplify.
Well, we had the shovels in full motion. There's probably more. People listening probably have their own flops of the year. But that's the big obvious lob balls that we're going to hit over the fence of poo today. Mm-hmm. So,
good survey. I hope that's helpful. I hope that stimulates thinking. If you got additions you want to talk about in a list, send us an email. You can contact us through our website. Greg, always a pleasure talking with you.
Fantastic. So that has been our 10-ish flops of 2023. And you know what? I'm hopeful there's going to be no flops next year, and we're going to get everything right in 2024.
Unfortunately, I think that'll be the first one on the list.
you're predicting I'm wrong. Well, you could be right on that one.
Hanging excellent. Fastball out over the plate. Coach said swing away. What can I say?
Hey, we've both been on the road quite a bit lately. What was the most interesting thing you ate during your last travels? Or nibbled on or drank or something unusual?
Oh, well, my daughter and her boyfriend from Miami came up to do leaf peeping with us. And we started out in Burlington and had a fantastic breakfast at a place called Friendly Toast. Best Irish Benny, that's Eggs Benedict over corned beef hash I've ever had in my life. And then 2 days later, wow, we were in Maine, where my older daughter and her husband joined us, and we had lobster. And oh my God, was it good. I haven't had a big steamed lobster in a while. So those are tied for the top.
As a good risk manager too, you ate your lobster during a month that started with or ended with R. So yes. I've been told that's the safe math to use for lobster.
That's correct.
I had oxtail for the first time, which is unusual. Everybody's surprised. Well, you've never had oxtail before, but I had it at a Miss Lickermore's restaurant in Toronto, which was over the top Caribbean food. It's 5-star Caribbean food. Who would have thought? And of course, I'm still dreaming of that brisket sandwich at Bucky's down in Dallas-Fort Worth I had at the gas station.
Wow. You know, and that's the real truth. You're in New Orleans and you want to have good Cajun or Creole, drive 15 miles out of town, take a right at the levee and stop at the first shack. And the odds are in your favor that you're going to have one of the best Cajun or Creole meals you've ever had in your life. There is a downside, but let's not talk about that.
Yeah. It's like lobster rolls in the Maritimes. Same things.
Yep. So,
cool. Well, thank you, Bill.
And thank you, Greg. Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for your time and attention. Cannot wait to catch up with you again, Greg. Be well.
Hey, cheers, my brother. Take care and all.
That brings us to the end of this edition of Real Cybersecurity. I'm Greg Young.
And I'm Bill Malik.
Thanks for your time and attention today and joining us on our journey. Remember to follow us on Twitter at Real Cybersecurity, and our email address is podcast@realcybersecurity.net. Thanks.